The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Andrew C. McCarthy is the former Assistant United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, whom you know probably mostly because he prosecuted the blind sheikh successfully. But he had a lot of years in the SDNY, which is the preeminent prosecuting unit in the United States. He now serves with National Review, commentator on Fox News, and he joins me this morning. Good morning, Andy. Welcome back.
Morning, you. Great to be with you.
Andy, I wanted to do a primer for our audience on the upcoming case in Manhattan. Alvin Bragg has charged former President Donald Trump with 34 felony counts of falsification of business records. That trial is set to begin on March 25th. This all goes back to the Stormy Daniels affair and the payments that Donald Trump allegedly directed Michael Cohen to make to her. Before we get into the specifics of how long this trial will go, can you lay out how he managed to stack 34 counts out of one night with Stormy Daniels and the payments that followed?
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Basically, you know, what he has done is he's taken one finite, what in New York ought to be, if he can prove this much, a misdemeanor falsification of business records. Generally speaking, if a course of conduct is basically a single transaction, prosecutors will charge it as a single transaction, and judges will sentence as a single transaction if it is proved. What he did was he took this single transaction and turned it into 34 felonies. And the way he did that was, the transaction we're talking about is hush money payments in connection with a non-disclosure agreement. It's called hush money, or it's described as hush money in the media because that's a, that's got a dark connotation. But in fact, non-disclosure agreements are legal. They are a staple of civil litigation and settlements in civil litigation. We hear all the time that the parties, close to some undisclosed financial settlement and nobody admitted fault. That we hear that kind of stuff all the time. That's basically a non-disclosure arrangement. And in this instance, prior to the election, Cohen, on behalf of Trump, paid $130,000 to Stephanie Clifford, who's a stage name, as it were, is Stormy Daniels, over an affair that she credibly claims to have had with Trump about 10 years earlier in 2006. So it was basically purchasing her silence.
So this is 18 years ago. It is alleged that the former president had a physical relationship with Stormy Daniels. She surfaced. For whatever reason, Michael Cohen made her money and paid her money from the Trump businesses and made 13 of those payments. Is that correct? Or 36 of the?
How many? Yeah, well, basically, Cohen used his own money. I think he drew on a line of credit that he had at a bank, but he used his own money to pay. And then, so flash forward, that happened around October of 2016. Beginning in February of 2017 and running every month through 2017 from there, it was agreed that Trump and the Trump Organization would reimburse Cohen. And the way they did it was basically to double the amount that he paid Stormy Daniels so that he wouldn't have a tax bite. And they paid him in installments monthly, beginning with two payments in February and then once a month through the rest of the year. And the way they did it was Cohen would provide an invoice, they would cut him a check, and then they would do a book entry. And what Bragg alleges is that we're trying to make that look like ongoing legal services when, in fact, it was payment of a debt from 2017. And what Bragg has done is he has made a separate four-year felony count into every single aspect of each of these installment payments. So each book entry, each check, and each invoice from Cohen is charged as a separate four-year felony, and that's how you get 34 counts.
Now, Andy, this is called stacking counts, and I have I've never prosecuted anyone. I've defended three criminal defense actions, so I'm way out of my league here, all right? That's not my world. But is it routine to stack counts this way?
The Justice Department actually tells you not to do it, and that's unlike the vaunted 60-day rule that we hear about from time to time, which is actually unwritten and doesn't really exist as a rule. This is actually Justice Department manual policy. You are supposed to charge enough counts so that you have a potential for punishment that is commensurate with what the real offense is. So, for example, if you have a fraud count where somebody defrauded somebody by, for $100,000, and if by charging three fraud counts, you can get 15 years of prison exposure, which would allow the judge to sentence to say, 6 years or something like that. That's enough. You don't charge, even though there may be, 100 mailings in the fraud thing, you don't charge 100 counts.
Now, Andy, I want to get to the idea of whether or not the president can have a fair trial. But first, I want to get to the idea of whether or not the underlying charge is credible if there's a defense here. And let's go down to the original transaction, the payment of an NDA, the falsification of a business record. If it was just one charge, is it credible in your view? If it had been brought within the statute of limitations, which was 2 years, we'll come to why it's been resurrected to 5 years in a moment. But if they had just brought the charge for falsification of business records, one charge within 2 years of the first payment to Stormy Daniels via Michael Cohen, would there be merit to that, or is an NDA sort of the ordinary course of business?
I think it would be arguable that there was merit in it, because what Bragg alleges is probably true, which is to say they were making their business records look like they were paying for ongoing legal services when in fact it was for payment of a debt. But that's a stretch unless the office routinely charged that kind of an offense, because we're talking here, as my friend Dan McLaughlin from National Review says, Trump basically lied to his checkbook. It didn't have any tax consequences. There's no allegation that anyone was defrauded. There's no evasion of money that's owed to the state. Trump simply on his own books misrepresented what the payment was for. And I think he's going to argue that on one interpretation, this actually was payment of legal services. Now, I think that's a reach, but you could argue for misdemeanor treatment of this if it was brought within the two-year statute of limitations. What Bragg has instead done is try to turn all of these into felonies and get the advantage of what turns out to be a six-year statute of limitations, because in New York, if you falsify your business records for the purpose of concealing another crime, you get the benefit of a five-year statute of limitations, and it becomes a four-year felony. And in this instance, it becomes six because New York changed its law during COVID to extend the statute of limitations by a year, because the courts really couldn't process cases. So that's how Bragg tries to squeeze.
And I'm going to come back to that secondary bootstrapping to felony, but I want to stay focused for a moment just on the original charge. There are a lot of NDAs out there. Just recently, the California Bar had me sign my annual statement concerning client trust funds, and I'm retired, so I don't maintain it anymore, that I will maintain that I have maintained my client trust fund free of intermingling with the firm fund, etc., the kind of statement you normally have to make for many state bars. And it is, in fact, not unusual for law firms to make payments on behalf of clients pursuant to their direction. Am I correct about that, Andy? That's my experience in California, but I'm not a New York lawyer.
Entirely correct.
So Is there? But we've already had March on the judge here, Judge Juan Merchan, M-E-R-C-H-A-N, reject all of the challenges that the former president's legal team has brought. Is there any interlocutory appeal of those rejection? Because this does seem to me to be a pretty ghastly court stacking, abusive process moment, Andy McCarthy.
There is, as I understand it, there is no interlocutory appeal on the motions that Trump brought, which were in the nature of selective prosecution, stacking of counts, statute of limitations, the fact that Bragg, as a state prosecutor, shouldn't be trying to prosecute federal law because the crime, he says, Trump was trying to conceal was campaign finance violations, which are federal statutes. Merchan rejected all of those claims. They are not subject to interlocutory appeal. Now, I should add that Trump at the 11th hour in the last few days has tried to raise his immunity claim in connection with this case to try to get it derailed prior to trial. I don't think he's going to succeed with that, but that may be subject to interlocutory appeal.
What's interesting to me about what you told me this morning is I thought all of these claims were beyond the immunity claim because they had occurred in 2016, but you're telling me the payments were made in 2017 after he became president. So it becomes an interesting question that ought to be delayed until after the court renders its verdict. Now, let me go to the bootstrapping, Andy, because I want people to understand this, and we have 2 minutes to the break. We'll talk during the break, and I'll bring you back on the other side. How does he use a federal statute that's never been prosecuted by either the Federal Election Commission or by any U.S. attorney that I'm aware of or the Department of Justice, Maine Justice? How does he use that? I mean, how does the judge not laugh that out of court?
Well, he takes advantage of the fact that the New York statute does not specify that the crime that you have to be concealing is a New York crime. So in theory, the way Bragg reads the statute, if Trump was committing a crime against, say, the law of France, it would be eligible for Bragg to call it
well put.
A concealed crime.
Well put. But it still has to be a crime, right? There has to be a crime that you can. This is not a crime, what he did. I mean, people do this all the time. It's not even fined by the FEC here.
Yeah, I have at least 3 points I want to make about that, you, because I think it's worth covering all the reasons.
All right, then hold on to it. We're going to go to a break, and we're going to put the entire transcript of this because the primer is necessary. I'm doing this not only for my audience, but for the media out there that just does not understand how bad this is. And I believe Trump's going to be convicted. I mean, I haven't asked Andy that yet. I think they're going to stack the jury. I think he's going to be convicted. I think they're going to have a sentencing trial. I think it's going to be a show trial right out of Beria. Show me the man and I'll find you the crime times. At Beria was Stalin's chief of secret police. And he said famously, show me the man and I'll find the crime. This appalls me and it ought to appall any American who believes in the rule of law. I'll be right back with Andrew C. McCarthy, former Southern District of New York prosecutor, learned man of the law, and good guy. Stay tuned. I'm back now with Andrew C. McCarthy. I'll play this later in the program, and it'll be on the podcast today. Andrew, hold forth on why it is so bad to do what Bragg is doing vis-a-vis reaching out for a crime that is not a crime, not in his jurisdiction, to take the payments made by Michael Cohen and turn them into 34 felonies against Donald Trump in Manhattan.
Well, first of all, as John Yoo has pointed out, it's a constitutional problem because the president and the executive branch of the federal government are charged by law to enforce the campaign finance laws, which are federal. So to the extent Bragg, a state prosecutor, purports to do that, he's actually invading what is the proper legal realm of presidential decision making. There's two different federal bureaucracies that enforce these laws, the FEC and the Justice Department. Both of them looked at this and decided not to enforce against Trump. Even if the campaign finance laws applied, Trump as a candidate is subject to different limitations than, say, Michael Cohen, who was a supporter. So there's even less of a basis to try to bring an action against Trump. But I think the two things I would point out are just like more of a real life thing you than a necessarily a legal principle. One is, imagine if Trump used campaign money to pay a hush money agreement with a porn star. How you know, the Alvin Braggs of the world would have you know, just exploded in wrath over that. And I think that just underscores that this is not a campaign finance. This isn't a campaign debt or expense. If you have something that would be a debt, irrespective of whether there was a campaign, that's simply not a campaign expense.
Correct.
Here, this was a payment of a debt that existed irrespective of the campaign. But the other thing that hits me like a thud, you, is that, Bragg's theory is that Trump stole the election. It was a very tight election with Hillary, and by concealing these payments, if voters had known about these payments, what Bragg's theory is that Hillary would have won the election. And even if you indulge the fiction that this was a campaign expense that had to be booked and had to be disclosed, the next disclosure period after Cohn paid this money would have been in the first quarter of 2017. That is to say, even if this was under the campaign finance laws, it wouldn't have been disclosed by law prior to the election. So the whole theory is wrong.
Boy, that people need to hang on to that. The theory is wrong, and somehow Judge Merchan said go forward with it. I am hoping the immunity motion last minute filed before now on the 25th knocks this back a few months, because this is a show trial of the sort we ought not to have in the United States of the nominee of the leading Republican, of the leading opposition party to the party in power, and it's just appalling. I'll be right back with Andrew C. McCarthy on the other side when we return to the radio show. Stay with us. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. A jillion years ago, I would take the West Side Rapid from 110th and Broadway down to Foley Square, and the federal courthouse was down there. I have no idea where this is going to be tried in New York. Andy, you're a New Yorker. Where is this going to actually be tried?
It's the state criminal court. I don't think it's the big Supreme Court building next to Foley Square. I think it's the criminal court on Center Street, if I remember right.
All right, and I do not believe it's going to be televised. Am I correct?
So far, that is correct. The last I saw on that was a report in the BBC about 10 days ago, where Merchan hasn't allowed any of the proceedings up to now to be televised. You know, I don't think much of Merchan, but I think to his credit, first of all, I'm not in favor of televised trials to begin with, but I think he is worried about getting a jury, and that does make it more difficult.
Now you brought me to what I want to get to, jury selection. If this gets underway on the 25th and is not stopped by an interlocutory appeal of something or other, the jury pool will come in there. Manhattan voted about 80-20 for Trump over Hillary, and Biden over Trump, for Hillary over Trump and for Biden over Trump. What are the chances that a Trump voter makes it through to the jury?
It's a 12-person jury. So, 20% of 12.
Well, don't they use their voir dire to kind of figure out, let's get rid of the people who are wearing MAGA hats?
Well, they try to, but the thing is that, the defense gets more ticks than the government does.
All right, so
the chance of them getting a favorable juror. It's not, I don't want to, I guess I'm pushing back you, because I tried a lot of cases in New York and I found the juries were very fair. Now, I agree that that's a million years ago, but New York has changed. But I'm also a New York conservative, so they are out there.
And now we do have to have the former president at the table. I believe I've heard you say that as a condition of his bail. He's going to have to be there every day, which is in the middle of the election. I can't believe we're doing this, but he's going to be there every day. What's your advice to the president about demeanor throughout the trial?
He should it's hard to advise President Trump because he thinks he knows better. And, there's a there's a trail of lawyers who've tried to give him advice to that it's in his interest to sort of rein his routine in. I think, however, that to be fair to Trump, this he's approaching this, as he did with the E. Jean Carroll case, as political combat, not legal combat. I think he thinks the legal result, like you do, and I think like I do, is kind of baked in the cake. He's very, very likely to be convicted here of at least something. And as we've described the stacking of counts, the logic of the case is if you convict him on one, you probably convict him on all 34. So I think he's going to fight this as part of the campaign and is not going to be terribly interested in some young lawyer telling him, you know, look, if you don't bring your routine in here, the jury's going to hate you and we're going to get convicted.
Should he, if you were advising him, should he use the opportunity that will daily present itself outside of the courtroom to speak to the American people about election interference? I mean, if I were him, I would get one message and I would repeat it 34 times. This was a show trial. This was a sham. This ought not to happen in America. I'm the nominee of the major political party, and this is a Democratic electee who ran on running this show trial, and don't be deceived. What do you think?
Yeah, I would do that with this client uniquely, because as far as like getting him to stop speaking, that ship has sailed. He's made so many statements about all this that they have plenty if they want to try to use it against him. And in the meantime, I think at this point, especially given what happened with the state trials and the E. Jean Carroll trial, Trump's got a very good message that this is New York against Donald Trump. And one of the things I would point out to you is that you and I are from the federal system where people
Correct.
Are appointed, and at least nominally, they get vetted by the Senate to make sure they're not going to abuse your authority. In New York, for the most part, even the judges are elected. Now, Merchan happens to have been appointed, but they have a mixed bag of appointed and elected judges. And obviously, this district attorney, much like the state attorney general, Letitia James, he ran bragging, pardon the pun, that he had sued Trump more than any other New York State lawyer in his prior life as a lawyer for the AG's office.
Will so, Trump be able to introduce the fact that Cyrus Vance passed on this case, the predecessor to Alvin Bragg?
Yeah, I would say good luck trying to stop Trump from getting in front of the jury anything he wants to get in front of the jury.
All right.
So I'm sure the judge may try to suppress that, but if Trump testifies, I imagine that's going to come out.
Oh, I don't think he's going to testify to you.
Well, it would be a bad look if he's going to do a press conference in front of the courtroom twice a day and then not, you know, make the 12-foot walk to the witness stand and testify.
Oh, geez. We'll have to talk about that during the break after I talk about how does one discredit Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, who are going to be, I imagine, the only witnesses. I don't think this is going to be a long trial, but I'll ask Andy, who's actually a real trial lawyer, as opposed to me, who's done it three times. Stay tuned, America. Andrew C. McCarthy on the specifics of the Alvin Bragg versus Donald Trump knockdown that begins, slated to begin on March 25th in Manhattan Criminal Court. Stay with me. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is, but we don't. I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is a. And it's healthy. It's wise. It's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
I am back with Andrew C. McCarthy, former Southern District of New York prosecutor, the man who brought the blind sheikh to justice. You read about him in National Review every week where Andy has a column. The McCarthy Report is a fabulous podcast, which I greatly enjoy, Andy. But I don't think enough people actually spend enough time talking about the specifics of the particular cases. So I really wanted to drill down on the Manhattan one. What do you see happening in terms of what will... it's not going to be Bragg. I'm not sure who the career prosecutor is going to be that's going to lead the case. What will they lay out first? What witnesses will they introduce, do you expect? And how best to discredit those witnesses when they come forward?
Well, as far as the witnesses are concerned, I think they'll have a gold mine, the Trump defense will, of impeachment material. There's very heavy reliance here on Michael Cohen, who is like a key figure here. And he has been not only convicted of various fraud cases, but when he first said this story to the federal prosecutors, who, by the way, rejected doing a criminal case on Trump before Cy Vance did. So it was the state rejecting it only after the feds had rejected a case on Trump. He was trying to sell himself as a cooperator to the Southern District. They didn't take him because he had too much baggage. He ended up doing a 3-year sentence. I don't know how much of it he actually ended up doing. But since he's been out, all he said is that he was double-crossed by the Southern District. So now he even claims that he didn't commit the crimes that he pled guilty to. So I think they're going to have a lot of fun cross-examining Cohen. And a big part of the reason, again, that Cy Vance turned this case away and the Southern District did is because you have to rely on Cohen to make it. Stormy Daniels' testimony will be necessary, and it will it's not as important. But it'll, as far as atmospherics is concerned, it would probably draw the most attention. But again, I don't think it's as important to the scheme that's charged as Cohen's testimony.
When Ms. Daniels is on the stand, do you want to ascertain whether she signed NDAs for any other people?
I don't know that I go there unless I was sure it helped me. But I would draw out from her the fact that, you know, she didn't just refuse to talk about this affair with Trump. She actually affirmatively denied that it happened. Now, the way that you have to worry with her that you could get clobbered, because she has since gone with a story that she was extorted, that somebody, you know, basically came up to her and told her to shut up about Trump. When she was in the presence of, I think, her young daughter, if I'm remembering the story right. So I don't think there's corroboration for that, but she does say it happened. So if you go there, that's going to be the comeback. But she has publicly asserted that she never had any romantic involvement with Trump.
So we have two problematic key witnesses. Are there any other, Andy? We got 5 minutes left. You've got a hit on Fox that you've got to make. So I want to make sure we get your estimate of whether or not he'll be convicted and where most of the defense team have got to put their pressure.
Yeah, I think the extortion that's going on now is the speculation about whether Alan Weisselberg, the CFO at the Trump Organization, will testify. He's just been convicted. He's prosecuted a second time in 18 months by Bragg. On perjury charges, and I think that was really just a shot across the bow to people who might otherwise testify favorably to Trump, to signal to them what they'd be in for if they tried to do that.
So your prediction?
He gets convicted.
They have 34 counts?
Most of the counts, if not all. Well, I just think the logic of the case, to the extent there has logic to it, is that if you get him on one, you get him on all 34, because what he's done is he's taken one thing and turned it into 34 things.
So now I go into the realm of the political. I've written this, and I believe it. I think this is going to help Trump, because it is so baldly a political prosecution. What do you think, Andy?
I agree, and the reason, I think the biggest reason for that is the thing we haven't talked much about, you, and that is Alvin Bragg. There's serious crime being committed in New York, including in Manhattan, and his default approach as like the paragon progressive prosecutor is either not to prosecute it or to plead it down from felonies to misdemeanors. Here, he's taken nonsense that I think shouldn't even have been charged as a misdemeanor and turned it into 34 felonies. And the only difference in the two situations is this is his political nemesis as opposed to his job.
It's a real test of the rule of law. I hope people understand the stakes here. Now, I think the obstruction case is Trump's serious problem, and we're not going to get there before the election, but this is a political prosecution. I think Jack Smith in D.C. is as well. The one in Atlanta has fallen apart. But this one really should offend any American who believes in the rule of law. Andy, you are always great to talk to. Thank you for walking us through this. Good luck. You're going to be in high demand for the next month, buddy. So get some rest, and I appreciate your taking the time with me.
Thanks so much. You appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Let me tell you about Alliance Defending Freedom. They help parents stay in control of their children's education. They do not want teachers going around parents when there are any issues having to do with anything to do with the fundamental rights of parents. First graders, for example, talk about switching genders. Well, they're going to do that because it's in the water, but parents should know about that, and ADF will work on behalf of parents who want to know. Cut. Let's play that cut.
To keep parents as in the dark as possible, the policy instructed teachers to file the plan in their own confidential records, not in student records, which parents have a legal right to see. In response to this abuse of power and dereliction of duty by the Madison Public School District, 14 parents, with the help of Alliance Defending Freedom, together with lead counsel from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, sued the district to uphold the fundamental rights of parents.
And they did. They win. They always win. Now, will you help Alliance Defending Freedom? You have five fingers. First, you give to your church. Secondly, you give to a parachurch organization. It can be focused, which, evangelizes Catholic kids on campus. It can be Young Life. It can be the Alliance Defending Freedom. They're parachurch. They work on behalf of religious liberty. Then you give to a school that helps you. Then you give to a school like Hillsdale that helps others. And then you give to a military charity. Number two, Alliance Defending Freedom. $10, $25, $50, $100, $500,000. You can do it via the banner at the top of HughHewitt.com. And I really encourage you. It's very secure, very safe, and ADF deserves your support. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Congressman Michael Gallagher. He is chairman of the House Select Committee on Engagement with the Chinese Communist Party, and it is a big day in the House. Chairman Gallagher, there should be a vote on TikTok today. Am I right about that? And if so, what will the bill do if it passes?
You are correct. The vote will be in our morning session this a.m., and if it passes, which I very much hope it will, the bill will force a divestment. The fundamental problem with TikTok is that it's owned by ByteDance. ByteDance is a Chinese company that is beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. And given TikTok's salience as a source of news for Americans under the age of 30, having a CCP-controlled company dominate the algorithm that determines what information America's youth gets is the fundamental national security concern. The risk of propaganda on the part of a foreign adversary is far too great. So this bill puts in place a framework, a regulatory framework, to prevent foreign adversary control of social media in America. Foreign adversary as defined narrowly as four countries: China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. And for those who have been unpersuaded that there is a threat, all you need to do is look at what TikTok did last week when the bill passed unanimously out of the Energy and Commerce Committee. They forced a pop-up notification on all their users, asked them to enter their zip code, and then had it call their members of Congress. The pop-up had completely inaccurate information. You had kids calling members of Congress threatening suicide if Congress took action on this issue. So we got a preview of how the app could be weaponized to influence our legislative process, influence our elections. Hugh, imagine if we were debating a bill to authorize the use of military force to defend Taiwan or to remove China's permanent normal trade relations status, and TikTok weaponized the platform accordingly. That's just a risk we can't afford to take.
Now, I was deeply disappointed yesterday when I saw Chris Coons, who I have great respect for. He's a Democrat representative of Delaware in the Senate. He is very, very good on China. He is very, very good on religious liberty. He's a good man and he's smart. And he was on camera saying we don't have to worry about TikTok and rush to a vote on this. I think every day that goes by, you lose another child to TikTok's malign influences and their messaging. What would you say to Senator Coons and others who don't think there's urgency here?
Well, I, too, know Senator Coons to be a very good man. He's an incredibly God-fearing man whose faith is very strong, and he's shared some very powerful stories about that. I just would completely disagree. And it's not just me talking about that. It's every single Biden administration national security official. Yesterday, we had our annual worldwide threats hearing where you have the director of national intelligence, the CIA director, the NSA director, the FBI director, et cetera, all of them have warned about the national security threat posed by ByteDance's ownership of TikTok. And in the unclassified Director of National Intelligence assessment that was made public yesterday, they said that TikTok is already being used to meddle in American elections. And I know that election integrity is a core concern of Senator Coons. And the final thing I would say is, I don't know the source of his concerns, but if it's some sort of, if he's concerned about the general user experience on TikTok and wanting that to continue, a world in which ByteDance divests from TikTok is a world in which Americans can continue to use the platform. Now, we as parents would then have a separate debate about whether that's healthy, whether there should be restrictions on social media in general. But the principle of denying foreign adversary control of the application, I think, is uncontestable. It does not endanger any free speech or First Amendment issues. If that were the case, previous efforts to change ownership of companies in the antitrust paradigm would have been significant First Amendment issues. That doesn't obtain in this case. There have been some suggesting that there's a bill of attainder concern here. Hugh, I hesitate to talk about constitutional law with such a distinguished constitutional lawyer such as yourself. But a bill of attainder, as you know, refers to a sort of a backward-looking punishment against an individual or entity, whereas this is a prospective regulatory framework for entities that are controlled by a foreign adversary. So I don't think there should be any concern about a bill of attainder being triggered.
Oh, man, that is such a Hail Mary pass. Now, you have worked across the aisle. This is a bipartisan bill that you have put together with your ranking member and your members on your committee. It went through the Energy and Commerce Committee led by Kathy McMorris Rogers, 50 to nothing. I'm wondering if you're going to call Angus King, senator from Maine, friend of mine, friend of yours, Democrat, independent who caucuses with the Democrat, very smart guy. You worked on the cyber solarium with him. Does he agree with you that we've got to get TikTok out of the hands of ByteDance?
Well, he was on a previous iteration of this bill in the Senate. So, yes, I believe he agrees with me. And I think he was the one who asked the questions of the DNI and the CIA director related to TikTok in the Senate earlier this week. His line of questioning was excellent. Angus and I, though we no longer chair the commission together, remain in close contact and we talk on a near weekly basis. So my hope is that he will emerge as a champion for the bill in the Senate. And I know that Angus more broadly sees clear-eyed the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party. He's been a forceful voice for that in the cyber context, in the military context. And so I would expect that he will be a key voice in the Senate going forward. And as I've said multiple times on your show, Angus King is a great American.
There is real urgency here, and I hope Chuck Schumer is aware of it, the majority leader of the Democrat of New York, a big supporter of Israel. The TikTok platform was used to poison young minds about Hamas when the war began, when the slaughter occurred. And they will use TikTok when Rafah is invaded soon. There is urgency, Congressman Gallagher. Do you think the Democrats get it? Because I think Joe Biden said he will sign this bill.
He did. And I say we've worked with the DOJ. We've worked with the NSC. We recognized that we needed a bipartisan coalition and we needed something that would survive a legal challenge. We invited technical assistance from the White House and incorporated some of that into our bill. There is urgency, and I think the entire reason this effort has renewed life when previous efforts have stalled is because of October 7th and because of the anti-Semitism that we've seen on the platform and the unexplained variances when you compare certain posts on Instagram, for example, to similar posts on TikTok. And there's wild variances when you start to get into topics that are related to Israel, and even bigger disparities when you get into topics that would be problematic for the Chinese Communist Party, topics related to the Xinjiang genocide. COVID origins is nearly non-existent on TikTok, where it exists on other platforms. So there's something going on here, and I think it's caught the attention of a lot of people, and I think Chuck Schumer will have an opportunity to do something about it. And the closer we inch to an election, the greater the risk comes from doing nothing. And so again, I hope we get a big House vote today such that the Senate can't ignore what we're doing. There's been a lot of senators who've reached out to me. Tom Cotton has been one of the clearest voices on this issue, as much as it pains me to give him a compliment. But he's been out there sounding the alarm for a long time.
Senator Cotton said yesterday on this show, Senator Cotton said yesterday on this show that it could be done in 5 Senate working days if they move fast. I'd like to conclude this way, Senator. A lot of my listeners don't have TikTok on their phones. Their parents, they're driving their kids to school as we speak. The kids are in the back seat complaining bitterly about listening to me inveigh against and complain about TikTok. Would you speak to those parents why they don't want their children on TikTok, what it does and how it distorts, not just propaganda, but just generally speaking, what it feeds into young brains?
Well, I've called it digital fentanyl for a reason. It is both highly addictive and destructive and correlated with skyrocketing rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide. And it can also ultimately be traced, like actual fentanyl and its precursors, back to China. So do you want America's foremost adversary, one that we know is intent on waging ideological warfare against the West and destroying the capitalist system led by America? Do you want that regime to occupy such a dominant place in the minds of America's youth? It makes no sense. It would be as if we allowed the KGB and Pravda to buy every major American news source at the height of the Cold War. And that probably understates the threat that we're facing.
I thought you might also add, it collects data on users. And so every single user of TikTok is compiling a file of their likes and dislikes, what they view, what they don't view, what they linger over. And it's not, they're not going through it page by page, but it's all there, right, Congressman?
That is the second threat. The data collection is a huge threat. There's been instances of TikTok using the platform to spy on journalists. And that may not seem like something an 18-year-old be worried about, but imagine that 18-year-old then goes out and wants to join the intelligence community or the military, and the potential for blackmail is a severe risk. So I do like the idea, however, of these kids being forced to listen to your radio show every morning. Perhaps we should, you know, have like a Hue talk or something, alternative app that we can push to America's youth.
Well, you know, we should now conclude this with our last minute. The Browns are having an excellent free agent season, signing Za'Darius Smith, a new running back. They've got themselves Jameis Winston to be their backup. I don't think anyone's going to the Packers, Mike. I think they've just basically given up on Green Bay. Are you guys out of the league?
We're still in the league. We did let Aaron Jones go, which was very sad. Aaron Jones is an incredible player, and I got to meet his dad before his dad passed away. His dad was a career Army guy. I met him at a tailgate. He came to a veterans tailgate we had, and he was awesome, just like super down-to-earth guy. And so Aaron Jones will always be loved, even though he's going to the Minnesota Vikings. He's going to go on the Favre journey. Join the Vikings. Everyone will be mad. And he'll come back and be welcomed as a hero.
But I also noted that yesterday, as I was reading my Green Bay Packers meltdown, I mean, it was just terrible news after a bit of terrible news, that Aaron Rodgers has been asked by Bobby Kennedy to be his running mate. And I thought, that's just perfect. That's absolutely, put a Packer on the ticket, and then we'll know for sure that Bobby Kennedy's nuts.
He's in point of fact a Jet, not a Packer. But yeah, it's been an interesting 24 hours dealing with these news stories and the misinformation about my TikTok bill. So, Hugh, I'm not going to lie. I need a win today, all right? The Gallagher family needs a big win today to reverse the momentum.
I think you're going to get one, Representative Mike Gallagher. Follow him online at Rep Gallagher, and there is going to be a big win, and I hope the Senate goes right for it and gets rid of TikTok before it gets even more injury on a daily basis to America's youth. Do not wait. Call your senator and tell him you got a bill coming your way, and we'd like it passed next week to get TikTok not shut down. It's just going to be sold to an American entity and get it out of the hands of the Chinese Communist Party stat. I'll be right back, America. Olivia Beavers joins me to give me the update on the Hur report yesterday, the Hur hearing, which went very badly for an incoherent Joe Biden in that transcript. Stay tuned. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Olivia Beavers is with Politico. She covers The Hill. Good morning, Olivia.
Morning, Hugh. How are you?
Good. I just had Chairman Gallagher sound optimistic about the TikTok bill, and I am too. What do you expect its prospects are in the Senate and the timeline on which it will move?
I think in the Senate, you're hearing quite a different sort of tone than you are in the House. I mean, two-thirds would be a pretty big show of force, and Chairman Gallagher says he wants even more than that. In the Senate, you're hearing maybe from Democrats and some Republicans that they might not move as quickly on this bill as you've seen in the House, which is they're moving very, very quickly for how the House actually traditionally moves with bills. Senator Cornyn, some other senators, I think they said that they had issues with it. So we're going to kind of see this debate kind of flare up in a different way. I just don't know at the moment what that entirely looks like.
But I've not heard Senator Cornyn yet. I did hear Senator Coons yesterday. I was very disappointed because I'm a great fan of Senator Coons, maybe my favorite Democrat along with Angus King. And I don't understand why anyone on the Republican side would oppose this bill. Do you have any idea what Senator Cornyn is opposing it for?
I'm not saying he's opposing it. I'm saying I think he's saying we're going to look at it carefully and review the legislation. One thing to kind of keep in mind is that there are leadership races happening in the Senate too. So I think that anyone who has their name in it, a lot of them have the name John, will be looking to see what their colleagues do in order to make sure that they're either able to not have a mark against them or distinguish themselves in that way. Republicans seem to be pretty largely on board with this. I mean, there are some in the House who have expressed concern, but it's members like Thomas Massie. Chairman Good, I think, has not said how he will vote. He's chairman of the Freedom Caucus, some Democrats. But it really seems like this has been an issue where Democrats and Republicans have been able to come together in a pretty extraordinary way. And you mentioned it earlier on your show, TikTok actually seemed to have pushed members who were on the fence to actually support this divestiture because of how they decided to handle their lobbying.
Oh, the Chi-Coms have never been subtle. And they're about as subtle as the Korean War. Olivia, let me turn to Robert Herr. I thought that was a disastrous hearing for Joe Biden yesterday, especially when Representative Jayapal attempted to put words in Mr. Herr's mouth that he had exonerated the president, and he pushed back, and I want to play that for you. My favorite quote, cut number two.
Your report is not an exoneration so much as a determination that the evidence as you saw it would not overcome the defenses that you had identified. Plus whatever lack of evidence you perceived. So it's not an exoneration, is it?
The word exoneration does not appear anywhere in my report, and that is not my conclusion.
And then Jayapal comes up and tries to pull it off. I mean, did she step on a rake there, Olivia?
I mean, it's one of like the most quoted moments, I think, from the hearing. There was he says it in sort of a parallel kind of comments. He goes, I did not have exoneration in my report. Jerry Nadler tried to get him to say it. But he also was seeing this on the Republican side where they said, you talked about Biden's memory. That was a huge moment. Would you call him senile? And he goes, that word does not appear in my report. So he was trying very hard to be very strictly into what his report said. Herr wasn't really entering a room where either side was particularly friendly to him. Republicans feel like he should have gone further and potentially charged the president for classified documents. And Democrats feel like he unfairly went after Biden's memory, which, if you look at the transcripts, some of those are quite telling. And I'm sure
he's a mess. Those transcripts show Joe Biden is a mess. We should have a dramatic reading of the transcripts. But Olivia, at the end of the day, I believe that her testimony hurt the current president badly and will show up in campaign fall ads. Do you expect it to show up in the ads?
Oh, I'm sure that anything about the memory, think that voters, Democratic voters, even in sort of, what is the word I'm thinking of? You know, when they meet in small groups and pollsters talk to them.
Focus groups.
Focus groups. Democratic focus groups show that Democratic voters see age as an issue, and that's what the Biden campaign is trying to fight against. And so here you have a moment where, you know, the president's trying to remember the year that his son died, and they have a special counsel talking about it. I fully expect that this would be something that they clip and they run again and again, saying, you know, Biden has an age problem.
Yeah, Team Trump is already out there. Play cut 21 for Olivia very quickly if she hadn't heard it.
Today, the United States is announcing an emergency package for Ukraine using cost savings from previously approved Pentagon contracts. The package includes munitions and rounds to help Ukraine hold the line against Russia's brutal attacks for the next couple of weeks, which I have the authority to do without asking Congress for some more money right now. But I've asked them for a lot more money. And but it's not nearly enough what I'm announcing today.
What do you make of that, Olivia? Big win for the president yesterday, or another slurred, he's too old moment?
I mean, I think that it's going to be, Democrats are going to say it was totally fine, and Republicans will say, we got you. And it's a moment for both sides to take part.
Let those who have ears hear. Olivia Beavers, follow her on X at Olivia Beavers. Good to see you, Olivia. Hour number three straight ahead, America. Stay tuned. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt in the West Coast, ReliefFactor.com studio. Next Tuesday, my home state, Ohio, will choose between three fine candidates to be their nominee to take on Sherrod Brown. I mean, they are all three very good men. State Senator Matt Dolan, Bernie Moreno, businessman extraordinaire, Secretary of State Frank Lucas. Donald Trump has endorsed my next guest, Bernie Moreno. He joins me. Bernie, welcome back to the Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm having all three of you on. I've been as fair can be, but you guys wouldn't let me run the debate, so you got hackneyed left-wing journalists asking you stupid questions. What's wrong with you people?
Hey, I'm with you. I wanted to have more debates, but my opponents have a terrible voting record in their time, their 30 years elected office. As you know, I've never held office myself, never even been on a ballot. I'm not surprised that they wanted to hide from the record, Hugh, and not be actually interviewed by a conservative.
Now, Bernie, it's very interesting down to the wire. Donald Trump stumped with you this weekend. Rob Portman stumped with Matt Dolan. I'm not sure Frank LaRose has a big endorsement. How does it feel to you? And please make your closing argument, because I am heard literally every inch of Ohio is listening right now.
Absolutely. Well, Hugh, this is a very, very simple election. On one side, you have me, endorsed by Jim Jordan, J.D. Vance, and of course, President Trump. On the other side, you have Matt Dolan, who's endorsed by Mike DeWine, who vetoed the transgender bill. Rob Portman, who, nice man, but certainly cares more about Ukraine than our southern border. And they're joined by the Cleveland Plain Dealers ultra-liberal editorial board. So those are the people endorsing Matt Dolan, and these are the people endorsing me. This couldn't be a starker contrast between an America First candidate and an America Last candidate. Matt Dolan would be the most liberal member of the Republican Senate were he to win, which dooms the America First agenda from passing.
Are you worried that Frank LaRose will take some Trump votes away from you, some voters who are influenced by the Trump endorsement? Because Frank made a point of pointing out yesterday he was endorsed by the former president in 2022, but you have been endorsed by the former president in 2024.
Well, I think President Trump endorsed him to be Secretary of State. He certainly didn't expect Frank LaRose to immediately, once taking his oath of office for a second term, to run for another office. That's something that only happens in politics, Hugh. You couldn't do that in your job, take a job and then immediately go apply for another one. So I think President Trump, rightfully so, endorsed Frank LaRose to be Secretary of State, not to be a U.S. Senate candidate. And the reality is he knows that I'm the one who's going to have his back in the Senate to make sure we get the America First agenda implemented. That means securing our border, energy dominance, trade deals that benefit America, peace and stability around the world. We can't have wars breaking out every corner of the world. And that's happening because of Joe Biden's weakness. That's what's going to end when President Trump gets back in office. But he needs people in the Senate that have his back.
Now, Bernie Moreno, I like to tell people, I love all three of you guys. I think the best three candidates I've seen. And the debate that we did the last time around was great. JD emerges the winner. But I find your autobiography, your story, to be among the more compelling stories in American politics. So why don't you tell it again? I know you've told it a million times, but tell it again.
Yeah, as you know, my family came from Colombia, South America. That's where I was born. We came here legally when I was a kid, became a citizen the first opportunity I could when I turned 18. I got to Ohio about 20 years ago, put every cent I had and then some, maxed out my credit cards, just all in, bought a tiny little car dealership, turned it into one of the largest car dealer groups in the country, sold that, started a technology company. And I just recently last year sold that so I could focus 100% of my time, effort, energy on running for the United States Senate. Because Hugh, I love this country. I absolutely love this country. It's going off a ditch. And the reason it's doing that is because we have job-seeking career politicians that care more about the job than they care about saving this country. That's why I'm running. This is about my kids and grandkids and your kids and grandkids.
Bernie, tell us about your family. I met your daughter. She was running your campaign 2 years ago. She sparkles. She had lots of charisma. But how many kids you got, grandkids? I don't think you got any yet. But tell us about them.
I do. I have 4 kids, 2 girls and 2 boys, 3 grandkids, 1 that's about to be 3 years old, a 6 month old and a 4 month old. That's why I'm running. My wife and I know that this country has blessed us with all the opportunities we could have possibly asked for, Hugh. Now, this is my opportunity to go back. I'm going to be dead someday and in heaven. I'm going to run into Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and James Madison. They're going to tell me their story of what they did when their country needed them. I'm building my story back. I'm trying to build a pretty good story, Hugh, of being able to say to them that in a time of need, when my country needed me, I did everything I could to save this country. And that's why I'm running.
Now, I always ask, and I've asked Bernie Moreno this before, what's in it for Warren, my hometown? And that just means Mahoning Trumbull, which is the heart of Trump land, by the way. You know that northeastern Ohio is the heart of Trump land and Ashtabula County. What's in it for Warren, Bernie Moreno?
That area used to be a thriving, wealthy, prosperous area with a great middle class. That's what has to come back here. That's what I mean by the America First agenda. The idea that we bring manufacturing back. We shouldn't be making 80% of our pharmaceuticals in China. We shouldn't be selling U.S. steel to a Japanese company. We need to bring that industry back to the Mahoning Valley, all over Ohio, and that means energy dominance. It means a good workforce. We shouldn't be stigmatizing people that get trade degrees like carpenters and welders, and instead rewarding people who get humanities majors that do absolutely nothing. We need to reset this country back to have a strong, thriving middle class so that cities like Warren can be prosperous again. And with President Trump in the White House, as strong senators, we'll get there, Hugh.
Now, Bernie, the early voting is not very heavy. What does it tell you, though? Have you been studying it?
Yeah, it tells us that the people don't know who we are. Obviously, they wouldn't have any reason to really know me well because I've not been a public figure. What I tell people is very simple. Look at who's endorsed us. Jim Jordan, J.D. Vance, Donald Trump have endorsed me. The Cleveland Plain Dealer, Mike DeWine, Rob Portman have endorsed Matt Dolan. It's very simple. If you think that the party should be the party of Bush and Cheney and Romney, then Matt Dolan's your guy. If you think the party should be Jim Jordan, J.D. Vance, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, and Donald Trump, then vote for me. We have 6 days left, Hugh. People got to go out and vote early. Make sure you vote on March 19th and get others to understand how important this race is.
Now, Bernie, let's close. You're a car guy and a tech guy. 6 days left. What are you doing in those 6 days, and why are you best positioned to beat Sherrod Brown? Because to me, if I was voting, I would vote for whomever I had assessed, and I haven't done this, who's best at beating Sherrod Brown, because he's tough. He's a tough cookie. Even though he's just way to the left of Ohio, he's a tough cookie.
Well, we've learned through history that we're not going to beat Sherrod Brown by putting Sherrod Brown light up. We're not going to beat Sherrod Brown by putting another career politician up. We're not going to beat Sherrod Brown by putting up somebody who's lived off of a trust fund that has not actually earned his own money and has been a political creature his whole life, just like Sherrod Brown. You need somebody to have a stark, sharp contrast. That's me, a business person, outsider, legal immigrant to this country that started with nothing and built a great company. That's how we beat Sherrod Brown. We have to have that contrast. And we need somebody fully aligned with President Trump, who's going to be at the top of our ticket. That's the key to me. Somebody who changes the name of the baseball team from Cleveland Indians to Cleveland Guardians should be nowhere near Washington, D.C., because they'll cave to everything down there, and they'll cave to the woke mob. I won't.
I do have to put my fact check in. I think it was Matt's brother who made that choice, not Matt Dolan.
He's part owner.
Part owner. He is part owner.
Part owner.
Let me
part
close,
owner.
Bernie.
All right, so we have a voice. But you're not the only senator here. You're not the only senator. So if you cave to others and being woke, just like he caved in his family situation, never spoke out against it, never did it. He thinks the Cleveland Indians is a racist trope that tells you everything you need to know about Matt Dolan. The reality is we need a strong conservative with a backbone. Because as you know, Hugh, D.C. sucks you up and spits you out. You can't have weak people there.
Okay, last question. What is the website and how much money do you have to spend and how much of your own will you spend to beat Sherrod Brown if you are the nominee?
The website's right here, right behind me, BernieMarino.com. I put in tremendous amount of money, not as much as my opponent. He lives off a trust fund. His family has enormous sums of money. But we've raised more money from individuals than any other candidate in Ohio history. We've raised almost $10 million. But every bit counts. If you want an America First candidate, go on BernieMarino.com and help us out over these next 6 days. We got to get the message out there.
Bernie Marino, keep coming back. If you are the nominee, great to talk to you again. Have a great closing kick. 6 days. 6 days left to really the most important Republican primary this year. We got to beat Sherrod Brown to get the Senate. Got to beat him. He should be beaten. He's left wing. He's way to the left of Ohio, which has gone to the right. And we will continue to follow this race closely. I'll be right back, America.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.